like to talk about stillness and movement. And movement that comes, that arises or emerges out of stillness. And also the movement that, what movement leads us to experience stillness. If we think of the poem last time where we talked, the poet talked about being still and his restlessness calmed down like circles on water. But what is that action that reveals stillness, allows natural stillness to unfold? So a movement that's not a reaction. Some kind of action that's not a reaction. So I have a friend and teacher who is Indian and lives in a suburb in India, in Lucknow. And he likes to make experiments. And so there is a place that we take our scooters to get repaired. Just as everything, almost everything happens very openly in India. So it's just along the side of the road, all the parts lying in the dirt, full of oil there next to the road, water buffaloes walking by, bicycles, etc. And someone had left a used scooter with a J, and it was pretty old, and it was hardly worth fixing. So Ajay decided to make the use of this scooter as a pretext for his experiment with the guy who runs the scooter shop. The scooter space. And so the idea was whether we could get this used scooter repaired without pressuring the guy, without saying, you better have it done in 3 days, or because I have whatever urgent need for it. There was truly no urgent need for the scooter. But Ajay was curious if there could be a relationship that wasn't about force regarding the scooter and getting it repaired at some point. And it was there for weeks and months and years. And so Ajay kept sort of upping the ante a little bit. He even brought sweets just for no reason, he would go by and how's the scooter, any work on the scooter happening? Here's a little box of sweets for you. He tried just pure friendliness and it didn't work. And I don't know if the scooter just stayed there or what happened to the scooter, because he's not someone who would then resort to force to get it done when it doesn't need to be done. And it was curious also his innocence in thinking that it would work and thinking, oh, maybe just another few days. And the conclusion was that the scooter guy was so busy that it wasn't possible for a shift out of his usual mode of dealing through pressure into responding to friendliness, and through friendliness wanting to actually get something done. And so I'm reminded of what Vanda Scaravelli said one time. I'll tell you another little story. Vanda Scaravelli learned yoga with Iyengar. She had the good fortune to have daily classes, one-to-one classes with him when he was in Switzerland. Quite some years in a row, not the whole year, but. And she in turn taught a lot of the teachers now who are spreading out over the planet. And so Sandra Sabatini was an Italian woman who went to study with Vanda. She'd come to a stuck place in her yoga. She couldn't get any further. She would try to do the asana in the same way that she usually would do them, and she would get not only feel uncomfortable but get feverish, high fever. And she loved yoga, but she didn't know what to do. And the suggestion was that she leave her family and go get a diploma in India, leave her three children behind. And so the burning question she had, along with trying to find a way in her own practice just to have some relief from this stuckness, the burning question was whether she could stay a mother to her children and continue with yoga. And so she met Vanda and they had some interactions, and then she brought out her burning question. And Vanda left the room and was nowhere to be found for half an hour. And when she came back, she said, "You don't have to leave everything. All that's needed is unlimited time and no ambition. That's all." "But you don't have to leave your family." So unlimited time in some sense, not necessarily literally. So you can take care of your children, for example. So that's a limit on the time. But when it's time for yoga, a sense of unlimited availability for it. And years later, Vanda admitted that when Sandra first asked the question, "Do I have to give up my family to practice, to continue with yoga? Is it all or nothing, one or the other?" Vanda had learned that it was all or nothing, one or the other. But when she heard this question, something kind of emerged in her heart. And so that's why she had to go outside and discover what her real answer was, what Vanda's answer to the question, so Sandra's question was. Not what the yogis of old had answered to their mostly male students. And so she came back with her own answer that she gave. But if Vanda hadn't been awake in that moment, she might have given the old answer, which would be, we could call a reaction. So unlimited time and no ambition. Do we believe that it's anywhere possible for there to be the giving of unlimited time for no reason, for no ambition, with no set goal in mind, without any intention, even? If we just let those words kind of slide our layers apart and feel how different that is from the accepted cultural mode, where it's accepted that ambition is the way we live. And then when we have some spiritual ambition, we can then push aside some work to make time for this other work. And it's all pushy, and there's not really time. So it's just a curious answer, unlimited time, to someone who's saying, "Is it all or nothing, one or the other? I have children that I love." Unlimited time. All you need is unlimited time. So I think that there's a kind of imperative to feel what have been moments that felt like unlimited time. What was that experience like? Sometimes it happens when we're traveling, so we're out of our daily routine. And I would put in a word for traveling. You can even practice traveling in the daily routine, leaving some time where you don't know where you're going or what you're doing, or you aren't sure if you understand the language or the way. And so you're a bit more loose too in how you are. It's one thing that I notice a lot in India when foreigners come to India with a sense of, there certainly is some time limit on the visa and the amount of money and certain obligations back home, often. But once there, there's often a sense of unlimited time during that time. And there's definitely a lot of not understanding the culture going on, for better and worse. And it gives a certain looseness in our behavior there that we don't give ourselves elsewhere, for better and worse. So sometimes the worst comes out, and sometimes maybe the best. So maybe it's important to give room, which means also time, where there's a looseness that the best and the worst may come up, may emerge. The worst reaction, the worst habit. So also now people tend to have shorter and shorter windows for vacation in the name of the crisis. And so people who will go on vacation, and it's known to be, we're going on vacation means we're going to be in liminal space, we're going to be apart from the regulations for this week or whatever. And so we'll drink a lot of alcohol, is one of the things that can happen. And so we won't tell anyone what happened there. It'll be between us, etc. So if possible, not even to go on vacation, but time for wandering around, even in our normal, seemingly normal daily zone. I think no ambition is a little bit, we can more easily feel when ambition is present. With practice, we can feel when ambition is operating and pressing on us. It can feel heavy, or it can feel fast, and it can feel out of center, forward maybe, or back, no way. And so part of our practice can be feeling for the looseness that could allow the best or the worst, and then also no ambition. Not even to be on vacation. Just playing with what is it like not to have brake or accelerator? Does anything else happen if we give what seems like unlimited time to neither brake nor accelerator? Is there some other kind of fuel, some other kind of movement? So this is another book, like the book of poems of Wendell Berry that I read one last time. The Ending of Time, I think that the title is a bit ponderous or preposterous or one of those kind of words. But it's an amazing dialogue between Jay Krishnamurti and Dr. David Bohm, who is one of those modern physicists, who they were friends as well. And they're also wondering about the subject of stillness and movement. And different kinds of movement. And they're very interested in the brain as well as the mind. And they're wondering whether the usual functioning of the mind, and when they talk about the mind here in this particular part of their conversation, they're not only talking about thinking, but thinking and emotions, but also they're calling it the whole. Emotions, thought, consciousness, the brain. The whole of that is the mind. Krishnamurti saying in this passage, sometimes he talks about it a little bit differently, I think. Emotions, thought, what he's calling consciousness, which he means in a material sense, and the brain. The whole of that as the mind. So David Bohm says, well, the word mind has been used in many ways. David Bohm's always coming in and saying, well, let's just slow down here. And now you're using mind in the word mind in a certain way, and you're saying that it represents thought and feeling, and he's adding desire and will, the whole material process. So David Bohm is adding to what Krishnamurti's defining as mind. So not just emotions, thought, consciousness, brain, but he's adding, he used the word feeling instead of emotion already, that's a little bit different, but desire and will to mean the mind. whether all of that is material process, so matter in motion. And David Baum has already confirmed in the beginning that all of that mostly is usually in reaction, and reaction we could start to realize is mostly material, that there are the neural pathways that are deciding how we're going to act for us. And I think with a bit of stopping and noticing, we can also notice that what we want, so desire, and how we push ourselves, so will, the power to move towards, mostly seem to be happening as part of this material process. And so then the question is, with all of this action, reaction, and action from the reaction, all of that as matter, movement of matter, let's go into here. What would be the way in? So Ajay tried to find a way in to reaction through friendliness, but there wasn't unlimited time and there wasn't no ambition. So Krishnamurti puts it like this, that there could be something called insight. That seems to be the only thing, that only insight into the nature of reaction as a way to end what he calls psychological reaction. Only insight into the nature of reaction and psychological reaction. And in typical Krishnamurti fashion, he says it in this kind of proclamation style, even though the tone of the conversation is very much an exploration. So I just want to bring in, it sounds like he already knew this and he's just telling us, but it emerged in the conversation. So it has its own authority through emerging from this honest exploration. But I want you to feel the aliveness that came, that it came out of. Only insight into the nature of reaction and psychological reaction. You can hear it that way. Or it's as a discovery, like only insight into the nature of reaction is what ends psychological reaction. And then David Baum comments and says, so matter is affected by insight, which is beyond matter. So insight, which is beyond matter, so it's not part of the material process, they haven't said yet what it is, not part of the material process, can come in and affect matter. So instead of the realm of insight being constantly, continually interrupted by the material process, which is how we usually live, there's the possibility of something not material interrupting the usual material process, matter affected by matter rather than by insight. So then they're trying to talk more about what do we mean by insight, and they use the word that insight comes from the emptiness that's also allowing the material process to go on. That allows also there to be the energy in the material process. So the emptiness, which we could use the word insight too in this conversation, is a movement of energy without any structure. So a movement of energy, so we could say that's completely fluid. It's without anythingness, without any structure. So it's a different kind of movement without anything in it, with no thing in it. So no ambition, no limit. And then I had the lovely experience of reading as a mother with children that I love to be with, so take care of. I'll read a part of it and I'll mark the page and then something else will happen. The snack time will happen or a game will happen and then I'll read the next part. So I had the chance to read a bit and have my own insight, which was what they're talking about is emergence. They're talking about emergence. And then the next page, I got to read the next page and yes, they used the same word. So this movement, not being part of cause and effect. So because something happened, I got irritated. And because I'm irritated, then the first thing I think is I shouldn't be irritated. Or there's some kind of brake that gets put on the irritation, whether I think it or not, whether I'm aware of being self-conscious of the irritation, or whether there's just some kind of brake of like, we don't be irritated. and then because of the not allowing the reaction to just be kind of a full-fledged experience. Krishnamurti also agrees that there's first the shouldn't be, there's the should and shouldn't, and it funnels into the shouldn't. And then there's the must control or justify. I must control or justify the irritation. And so then we either empower the irritation through thinking that I'm right, or we empower the irritation through thinking that it's wrong. So that's an example of reaction, where there, something happens and then the cause is irritation. That's the predictable path. And then the next predictable is I shouldn't, it shouldn't be. It's not okay. And then the second, and we've left deep okayness to enter the conversation, is not okay. And then must control or justify. So I've got to repress it or pump it up into the presentation. That's all a chain of reaction that also branches out. It's not only, unfortunately, it's not only a linear change, but chain of reaction, but it's a branching chain of reaction. So we have this lovely word in Sanskrit. Sanskrit, it's prapanch in Pali. You might have heard prapanch, pancha, propagation of thought. So it's not only the linear chain, but the branching chains of reaction, where there is a cause and an effect, and it's predictable. It's shaped by the past. And if that would be all, there would be no way. There would be no way. And so that's their conversation, is so why is it that there is somehow, sometimes a way, and what would be the way? And if we can make it, if we can clarify what would be the way for things not to follow the chain, then maybe that will help people who are wanting freedom from the chain of time, of reaction, to allow something else to emerge. Yes. So there's a few more good lines in their conversation. I'm down to using my boarding pass stub as a bookmark here. So then they're looking for, where could this other element be? This emptiness or insight, whatever we want to call it, fluidity, we could say. So Krishnamurti just raises the question. We're talking about that whole, the normal mode of experience, all that we normally experience. So thinking, emotion, consciousness, will, desire, the brain. The main way that we, our main identification, and the main what is usually the whole of our experience, conscious experience, that whole thing. One can see that this materialistic reaction can end. And the next question I'm asking is whether that emptiness is within or without. Is it in the same place as the material structure, or is it somewhere else? Is it elsewhere? And David Baum is like, well, where would it be if that's what there is? I like the back and forth. And Krishnamurti says, I don't think it would be elsewhere, but I'm just putting the question. And so then they find that it couldn't be outside of that. It can't be separate from that. That's what they decide. And so then what's the next step? Does that emptiness contain nothing, not a thing? And David Baum agrees, not a thing, by which we mean anything that has form, structure, or stability. So all of that, form, structure, stability, reaction, capacity, all of that is not in the emptiness or insight. So then what is it? Is it then total energy? So then they talk about it being a movement of energy through time, tremendous energy that is not still because it's active. So it has tremendous energy, so it can never be still, but in that energy it has stillness. The movement can be said, and here they finally got to my favorite word of the year, the movement can be said to emerge from stillness. And I'd like to bring in another one of my favorite books that I didn't discover this year, but quite some years ago, a Sanskrit text called the Yoga Sutras. Just the very beginning, first few lines of it. And I'm going to go pretty quickly over the the very first couple of lines till we get to practicing the practice of stillness and emergence. So it's lovely how the text begins by saying, and now, the teachings of yoga. So clearly something has gone before, but that's not in this book. Now, the teachings of yoga. And then they define yoga. Yoga is to still the patterning of what they also call, they're using consciousness in quite a similar way that I think Krishnamurti is, something that is physical. But in this case, the word is chitta, so it's not capital C consciousness. It is individual. It is, let's say, where it gives a place for those shapes to happen, to be placed. The shaping that's happened through our past experience. The consciousness, the chitta, gives a place for that shaping of the mind to happen, to be stored, to have a basis. And that's where William Blake says, if the lens of perception would be cleansed, we would see things as they are, which is infinite. So we have, again, infinite or timeless, without time. So yoga is to still. So stilling, nirodha, is also to stop. So I don't want to try to make it too poetic and not realistic. The word nirodha is used now in India to mean for birth control, to stop that particular material creative process from happening. So stopping or stilling. Stilling the patterning, the vrittis. So vritti could be called, I like how in this translation that I found online, that someone, thank goodness, lent me this iPhone for the month so that I could look this up. I've been traveling for 6 weeks with this book with Iyengar, actually, the teacher of Vandas Karaveli that I mentioned before, his Sanskrit to English translation of the Yoga Sutras, knowing that I wanted to teach it sometime this summer. And then I didn't do it in North Carolina, and I didn't do it. And finally, I was like, I'm not bothered going to bring this to Double Bear. And then, of course, that's where I went. Luckily, it's online. So the patterning, to not still the consciousness, but to still the patterning of the consciousness, to stop the reactivity, basically, to stop what would make the predictability happen to consciousness. And to make that be so easy to take as the only reality. So they're using for the word vritti, that the patterning that's on consciousness, that consciousness gives a place to land, that then affects our perception and experience. They're calling it pattern. It can also be called like a warp or a wave. And if we just keep sort of that new physics in mind in terms of thing and no thing and patterns and waves and particles, things and no things. So yoga, which is also, of course, I'm sure you all know by now, like it's like a yoke where we put something together, but it's also union. So union also, the teachings of union are talking about union as the stilling of the patterns on that individual consciousness. Then there's the line that maybe no one can translate well, so I'm going to give you a more word for word version of it. So then tada drishti, seer, what sees or who sees, one who sees. So people would call it the witness, but it's actually, that's so easy to start to think of as like a person in the control tower or whatever. And it isn't. It's, if we think more of, if we just even now with our literal eyes as one example of the experience and also as a metaphor for a deeper kind of seeing, what is it that sees through our eyes? If we use the word what, so what sees rather than who? What is it that allows seeing to happen? So then, what sees, you can say, if we can also then dissolve the what, the seer who's not a person or a thing. Has a state of abiding in its own form. So they give the deepest possible teaching first in the shortest possible form. So when the stilling of the patterns, when the stilling of the waves and warps on the individual consciousness, on the individual citta, are still, then what sees, and also we can have the example in meditation when there has been a lot of thinking and the attention has gone with the thinking, and then there's somehow that we realize, something realizes that's been thinking, there has been thinking. We say, I have been thinking. But then something else notices that I have been thinking. And even if I wasn't aware that I was thinking, though the attention went with it, something else can see all of that and often could even remember that whole train of thought, that whole chain of reaction could even be remembered from somewhere else that wasn't I, but that sees. So then that seeing, let's say, can have a state of abiding, can rest in its own form. And in this, that's all it says. It doesn't tell us what they mean by own form, swarup. But they use the word own form, which I really like because it does feel like there are actual shapes that cause the warping of perception. There are actual shapes on the individual consciousness. And those shapes are what we defend. Those shapes hurt us. It hurts to live by them, to be in the slavery of those ways that we've been shaped by our experience. It hurts to live by them. And so then we feel we need to defend. We make a thicker skin and a thicker skin. And some other kind of form, which again we could say a formless form, we could say a shape, a fluid shape, might be what they mean by own form. When we have those moments of feeling at home on the planet or feeling at home in our skin or even feeling at home with someone, there's a little bit of that sense of familiarity with mystery that kind of reverberates very deeply. I think it can give us a sense of how there could be a home that's not a actual place, that's not physical. Are there any questions yet? Or comments? Yeah.
Idea of the energy, intent, not the reaction. Seas of influence. To be clear.
Can we call it direction instead of intent?
Would be without an agenda, without expectation. It can have coming from a non-form, going to a non-form. Could still have that insight.
Yeah.
That something was aware of its movement, and in that awareness, creating it, even without intent.
Yes.
Is what I'm.
Yeah.
And. My question is, was I this morning, I, thinking on those very same lines?
That I hadn't read until this afternoon.
Yeah. And I don't know if I mentioned that to you yesterday or to Jenna, how I get like I'm in this ocean of continuum of being in the same place that all things are and still feeling an identity.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not, it amazes me. I'm not terrified or, it's a question, kind of.
Yeah.
Creates. It creates emotion in me.
Mm-hmm.
To be part of it.
Yeah.
And not, I can't explain it. But even as I dwell into these questions, like this morning, I was dealing with those very specifically the same questions of the discussion that you were reading about. That was my line of self-questioning about intent of energy, its form.
Yeah.
And it creates.
Yeah.
An emotion.
Yeah. Is it that you feel very touched to be part of it? Is that what you mean?
Made me cry when you started reading because I felt so identity. I was going, whoa.
Yeah.
And it was, and I cry out of joy, it seems, nowadays.
Yeah.
That's what.
So maybe now that's your practice. Partly is to be touched and to let it be more normal that you are part of that. And so the work of loving yourself and through the loving whatever happens, whatever dissolves or arises, gets stronger, dies.
That sounds like growth or what, emergence or occurrence.
Yeah. So then the next line is, it says, otherwise, awareness takes itself to be the patterns, the warps, the vrittis.
Say it again.
Otherwise, so if there's not the stillness, then, otherwise, so then, awareness takes itself to be the patterns, to be the warps, to be the vrittis. So it can, to give you the more word for word, it's the line before was, then the seer rests in its own form. Otherwise, there's identification with the vrittis. Vrittis, so the patterns, the shapes. The added shapes, the extra shapes, the history, stored history. So that's the introduction to yoga. And then they want to tell more about what the vrittis are. What are the five types of pattern, or warp, or wave, or distortion, or shape? It says there are five kinds. And then it uses a word, you may have heard in Buddhism the word klesha. So in Sanskrit it's klishta, klishta klishtaha. There are five types of pattern, of shape, of history stored. Hurtful and unhurtful, literally, or you can say twisted and untwisted, twisting and untwisted. So when it's twisted, it then twists or tortures or torments. And when it's untwisted, when it's straight, it's not so painful. It doesn't hurt. And the names of them are praman, which is right perception. So that's where it's not twisted. And we'll go into a little bit more detail in a moment.
But it's still from history.
It's still a pattern. Yeah. Viparyaya, which is misperception. So there's clear perception and then there's misperception. And then there's like from the verbalized or conceptualized. And then there's sleep. And then there's memory. So right perception or clear perception and then misperception. And then when it's purely verbal, when we're asleep, and when it's memory. So the first one, the clear perception, is really interesting that it's considered a pattern of the mind. When there is the pattern of clear perception, praman, what's happening is either direct observation, so we talked about last time direct perception, where there's exchange, where there's not so much sense of separation. There's direct observation. Like we said last time, white is white, black is black. There is not all the association and so on. There could be what's called anuman, inference. So we see smoke, and so we think probably there's something hot over there. Maybe a fire, maybe coals. And that would be where I'm not making it up. So we notice something small and we get a bigger picture. And it's accurate. And then
relatively.
It's a patterned accuracy. Yeah. And then there's the words of others. So whether it's through live teaching of a person or teaching through a text. Something that we resonate with that feels true. So this is accurate perception. It's either direct observation, inference, or a kind of accurate teaching, we can say, true teaching. Another thing that we can give as an example here is when there's actual, not just direct sense experience without intervention. It's also deeper spiritual expenses. That might help us understand why it's a problem. Another example, that when we hear that direct experience, direct observation, it's not only talking about sense observation. It's not only talking about literally sense seeing and hearing and so on, but also deeper spiritual experiences that are true, let's say. It's an accurate experience of ourselves. So we might experience spaciousness or brightness or something like that, that we wonder if we're imagining it at first, but then it's come so regularly with practice and it has a certain subtle living quality to it that we start to realize it's just as real as the other physical senses, sense experiences. So, but those experiences also are not yoga. And my slip of the tongue calling it expense instead of experience maybe gives us a sense. Sometimes because we could have a deep experience or a direct sense experience, which also can have a lot of, can reverberate quite deeply. And we stick to that so that we've lost the fluidity. There's also the way that experience came in a certain way. So it's as if it came in a certain language. And so we are, that could be a shape that was shaped, and it could also then shape, further shape us. So somehow allowing these important experiences that are accurate and true and sometimes need to be acted upon, we see fire, we need to put water. While staying in touch with the fluidity of the trueness of the living quality of the experience. Misperception is what we probably most commonly live by, where we're sure that we're experiencing directly. We think that we're really in touch, that we're seeing what really is. And what we're in touch with is our own hallucination, our own usually fearful projection, basically. So misperception, viparyaya, false knowledge, and the word for word would be false knowledge, so mithyagnanam, so false, misleading knowledge. And then atad rupa, not that form, so not actually based on the actual shape of things. So not even in touch with the shape of things. I think where this is most important for us is in the interpersonal realm, where we really experience someone as aggressive or fearful or less than or higher than or whatever. We take that as really, I like how they say it's not that form. It's like what we're perceiving is not a form. It's not actually, it doesn't actually have any shape or basis. But when we experience people and we experience them as such and such, we experience it as it's like as heavy and strong as concrete. It goes so easily unquestioned. And then there's that where then we also, it is uncomfortable. And so there's the should or shouldn't, and then justify or control. So if we can practice interpersonally, even in silence, well, especially in silence where it's easier to practice interpersonally, feeling for the fluidity of the actual experience of being around people. And to feel where there comes a sense of heaviness, whether we feel someone's higher or lower or even equal to, but there's a heaviness there that doesn't suit our nature. And then we spend so much of our energy, so much of our quality time is spent in feeling the heaviness and that shouldn't be like that, and then controlling and justifying. So much of our energy goes into that. And if we could start with feeling the heaviness, so then we have a direct, accurate perception of the misperception. And we can start to find the fluidity again. And that can actually help not to go into dynamics where it would be the most likely thing to happen. Because maybe there is quite a lot of heat coming from someone. That's not all there is. But. And certainly that heat coming from someone is not... the way that I was trained to experience heat from my mother all those years, and therefore the concrete version of the person.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah, please.
What you're talking about there is our process of judgment, the way this particular body-mind perceives and misperceives.
Yeah. And to take into account, when we say judgment, I easily start to think of the more verbal, which would be the next one. The verbal judgment of where I'm aware of judging someone. But if we take also into account the really visceral, like the organism that wants to move away from or get close to because of a visceral, totally unconscious, usually, reaction to people that we can't help having. It, we have it. It's there. Maybe it will get still with practice. That seems to be possible. But if we can acknowledge that that's happening and that it is so uncomfortable, and it's not the person's fault that it's uncomfortable. The person might be one of those people that's prickly, etc. That might be also the case, but our way of taking the person is what's weighing on us.
Moving away.
The moving away or towards. Yeah.
From our own reaction.
Because of our, well, there's the reaction of moving away and towards,
yeah.
And then that's heavy, and then we further shut down because we don't understand that the heaviness is the reaction. Yeah.
In that process, we're believing our own story.
Yeah. But here, it's a nonverbal story.
Yeah.
I agree there's not a better word than believing, but I want to just say again.
Even in the gut.
It's the body believes the story.
Yeah, us believe it.
Totally. Yes. Yeah, exactly. I haven't found a better word than believe either, but belief does feel quite mental and verbal. And it feels so experiential. And there are these books that they're pretty helpful. I can't remember the name of the author, but The Body Doesn't Lie. They have some helpful kind of stories and ideas in it, but
I personally tried to relate to it chemically,
mm-hmm.
as though we all have valences,
levels
of attraction and repulse,
good.
Where we fit or don't fit others. But even that is believing that story.
Yeah. It's somehow buying into that some kind of charge. So we can call it some kind of valence, or that's good. I like that.
This word covers a lot of what you're talking about. We often use the word image.
Yeah.
It's like set image.
Yeah.
Set images.
Yeah.
Stored images.
Yeah.
Fixed images.
Yeah. But still, image for me goes up here a bit. Like, I agree with these words, and I'm happy if we can find a better word. But if we think of image as a three-dimensional, let's go there, a three-dimensional experience.
Well, that's what we do when we're
an organismic stored image. That's also good. I like that. As a subtle form that's so easy to take as our own form, as true. So there are these books that talk about, I think even the title of one of them is The Body Doesn't Lie. And it's just, what it's talking about is how often there'll be physical symptoms that will come out when we're trying to avoid kind of dealing with certain deep wounds in the psyche. We're trying to avoid them. We're falling into the pattern so often that the body ends up giving a symptom to get us out of it. So that's helpful, but I don't think it's true that the body doesn't lie. I think the body does lie also. I think we also do have symptoms that are not revealing some deeper truth in the psyche, but are expressing our conditioning. So someone might hear something or see something or experience something and feel nauseated by it because of conditioning about what they're hearing and how they're receiving what they're hearing. Maybe if I just give another brief example from my friend Ajay. When he was a small child, he grew up in caste Hindu India, and he was not in the lowest caste, not in the highest, but not the lowest. And his family, part of the village system was that there were families that were considered that were living as lower castes in the caste system. And they had a certain relationship with different families. And one of them would be like as the barber, and in exchange for doing the shaving and the haircutting, then they would also get certain mango trees would be theirs in the grove. Those mango trees were theirs, you couldn't touch them. That was part of the exchange. For example, just to give you a sense that it's not, when we hear the word caste system, then there could be revulsion because of how we receive that word, for example. It's another good example of a wave that's been built into the citta. the living reality of it was quite different from what we've heard of it. I'm not saying we should use that system, but there was some, a lot of human contact that there isn't now as the caste system develops. There are people who are still barbers who don't get to have the mangoes from the tree, let's say. They just have to earn the cash. So there was one man who was in that caste that Ajay loved to hang out with him and as a child and watch him. And that man had his one bowl and his one cup. And so that one bowl and that one cup were very well taken care of and were always very shiny and stored up high to keep the cats away or whatever, cats and rats and dust. And so Ajay was fascinated by them, and he one day climbed up to get the shiny cup and to drink water from it, which is considered a breach of caste. It's considered that you shouldn't drink from the cup of someone from that lower caste. That would be polluting to use their cup, however shiny and clean. So as the child, he didn't have that built in yet. And then just only a few years later at school, it was a school that was, we would call it integrated. So the caste system is no longer legal. So there were children of all the castes at the school. And there's the water pump where they would get their water to drink. And the children were daring each other to drink water from the lower caste child's cup. And Ajay did, because he's that kind of guy. But he had by then received so much conditioning about it that he vomited after drinking water from the cup. So just sometimes we might feel a reaction in the body, and that would justify, that would act as justification for a reaction that we've had that we then think there's something wrong here, and then we justify it instead of questioning. This is a chain of reaction that I actually don't belong to, and it doesn't belong to me, and what would be another way? Where's the fluidity, the emptiness, the insight that could come into this chain of reaction? And from the non-material, from out of time, could change what's happening in time. So just, I've just saw the time, speaking of time, we're over time. So the other three forms of pattern, forms of form, types of form, conceptualization. So I like the word for word literal translation much better than the way when they put it into a nice English. There's this third kind of pattern or wave or distortion. Is verbal knowledge that follows the lack of object or substance. So it's not based on, it's following along without being based on an actual object. It's purely based on verbal thinking. I think we know that arena quite well. Yes. That's what we're most encouraged to do and identify with, etc. That's most valued. Cash and concept. Then the fourth one is deep sleep. A pattern grounded in the perception that nothing exists. So the non-experience of sleep. Pratyaya is the perception resting on non-experience. That's what they're calling deep sleep. A perception resting on non-experience. So this is, I love how there's the several different ways of taking actual experience. There's accurate experience, accurate perception, and misperception. And then where we just go on and on verbally, way somewhere in the distance might have been some real object or not. And then there's a perception, which is a pattern in the mind, trying to make something of non-experience, let's say. Not trying to make something of, but where in us there is a making of a perception of non-experience, and that's sleep. And in Buddhism, there's a state that comes about through a lot of practice where we've gone through letting mindfulness be completely covering us and brightening the inside of us, and we experience no thing, we experience everything as consciousness, etc. And finally, at the end, there's neither perception nor non-perception. So rather than needing to make there be some kind of perception always, the possibility of allowing there to be neither perception nor non-perception. It's just an interesting possibility through deep practice. And in that,
is that samadhi?
It is also samadhi. Like if we translate it back from the Buddhism back over to the yoga system, that would be samadhi. Yeah. And that's where these patterns in the mind can be, are, it's not that they can be dissolved, but that's where they do dissolve, where they do melt, where the vritti, where the distortions do happen to get dissolved. And then the fifth type of distortion of consciousness, of the deepest place of us, of the individual, is memory, remembering. And what remembering, they define remembering as not allowing to be stolen away, the phenomenon or the object of experience. So there was something experienced, and not allowing to steal away that experience is remembering. So there's a way that whatever we may have experienced, even that could be fluid, even that could be no thing, could be no object.
Say it again.
Even whatever, something has really happened to us, there was a real happening, a real object, a real phenomenon that we actually experienced, so we didn't just think about it or whatever. That this is indicating that that could naturally just stay as not a thing, stay as fluid, stay as living quality. But there's a not allowing to be stolen away. There's a guarding it, you could say. But the literal thing is not allowing to steal away an experienced object of experience. That is remembering. So then the nature of experience would be that it gets stolen away, that it's traceless. But there is this possibility of not letting it be stolen away, which is a distortion of the individual consciousness.
And the letting it be stolen away part, is that Maya, the notion of illusion?
No. Because Maya would be more all of these vrittis, including memory.
Okay.
So living without memory would be beyond Maya, or would be being very comfortable with Maya. No problem with Maya. Maya is not deluding me. I allow there to be illusion as illusion. It's as it is, but it isn't a thing also. Yeah, there could be dance with Maya, not needing to guard special experiences of whatever kind, negative, positive, etc. So practice and non-reaction, these are stilling or stopping. These are what still and stop these distorting movements. Practice is the sustained effort to rest in the stillness. So there is this, you know, they use so few words, each line is just reduced to the minimum amount of words, and they actually go to the trouble of saying that practice or action, so practice, the same word for practice could be called action or method, but let's call it action or practice, and non-reaction, these nirodha are stilling, these still, or these stilling. In that, tatra, steadiness, sustained effort, practice. So practice with steadiness and sustained effort. So continuity, unshakability, an action that is sustained. So we're starting to get towards action that could start to come, emerge by itself, out of nowhere, out of no thing, out of no ambition and unlimited time. But there is yetanos, this sustained effort. So there's the possibility of trying, of somehow trying to come out of the chain of reaction, that force, the forceful agenda, the forceful momentum in the particular direction, the predictable direction. There, it's possible to sustain effort, and we can call that practice or action, sustain effort to rest in the stillness, to let stillness move us. So practice as the sustained effort to be moved by stillness, moved from stillness. And this practice becomes firm ground. And they really use the word ground that has been like very, very muddy, almost watery, drying up and being firm enough to stand on. So this, I love this in the talking about no form and fluidity and no place, but the practice brings about that kind of firmness or sense of ground in the fluidity. So the practice needs to go on for a long time. Again, they're really using these words. They're if they only gave themselves 100 words, they're using a word to say long time. Dirgha kala. So just a sec. So this sustained effort to be moved from stillness, this and long time, dirgha kala, continuously. So he's saying specifically again, for a long time, continuously or uninterruptedly, I like the word better, nairantarya, and also another long word, satkara sevita, sevito, sorry, skillfully cultivated. So for a long time, uninterruptedly, so the limitless time, uninterruptedly, so no ambition, there's not an ambition coming in to interrupt, skillfully cultivated also, no ambition. It's... that allows there to be the sense of firm ground, that there's the way I would put it now is sort of loving that staying true to the fluidity, loving to love what we love, loving to love what we love. That is like firm ground to stand on through sustained effort, steady effort, to allow action to come, to emerge out of stillness, out of nowhere, out of nothing. And for if this is a long time, uninterrupted and skillfully cultivated, for its firm ground. I'll just finish this and then. As for non-reaction, so that's action coming out of, emerging out of stillness. As for non-reaction, so practice and non-reaction are what still the vrittis, the distortions, the programming. So practice, they've described. As for non-reaction, when no matter what is seen or heard or learned, so any object of experience, any phenomenon, there's a mastery of understanding, samgya, so that there's, again, there would be no ambition, there would be no wanting to make it go a certain way. That's non-reaction. So with understanding, a mastery of understanding, there's not wanting things to go a certain way. There's not having ambition, there's not having an agenda. No matter what we see, hear, or hear of, learn, no matter what object or phenomenon. So we can tell when vairagyam is the word, when the non-reaction has, non-reactivity is fully present, when no matter what happens, when there's that, basically, in the deep stillness, there's such a trust of life and the deep stillness, that no matter what happens, there's a sense of the dignity of that place, the preciousness of life, that's never touched by anything that could happen. And that's what's trustworthy for any response to come out of there. So things may need a response, obviously. We're not talking about just going into somewhere and staying in a cave inside us. It's about action and non-reaction, non-reactivity, we can say. So, but where there needs, where there's an imperative for some response, if we can learn not to come from the reaction, that's predictable and programmed, that we can see clearly, like that's why the word comprehension, the mastery of comprehension or understanding, that the reaction is not going to help. The reactivity will not help. But it's not that nothing will help or be worth bringing into the situation. The responsiveness that emerges from the stillness, from staying true to the fluidity, from having no fixed place, that responsiveness is worth bringing through. So not necessarily non-reaction as no action, but responsiveness from the stillness. So coming not to trust the reactivity, so our practice is partly to feel what reactivity feels like and to notice whether it's ever helpful, ever, at all. And then what else is possible? Oh yeah, fluidity. Oh yeah, I have no, my home is no place. And whenever something's fixed, it hurts. And the fact that it hurts and feels heavy is already my freedom, because then there's a natural, oh, okay, that doesn't fit. So what does fit? But giving ourselves a long time and the possibility of sustained effort that's skillful. And the skillfulness comes not from the reactivity and not from taking our practice as being a particular thing or savior or whatever, a new kind of reaction. This is the tricky part, because otherwise we will spend 30 years meditating and not be living. Chris. Did you want to say something?
Practice, persistence, all I wanted,
yeah.
I wanted to say.
I've
used to describe that, those characters, the three.
Yeah.
I used the word constancy.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
I wanted to interject that.
Nice.
And I also want to ask a question.
Mm-hmm.
The need to want to say, hey, teacher, constancy.
Mm-hmm.
I look at that as, and I go, Chris. She's trying to say something. Shut your mouth. And at the same time, I want to identify, because I so strongly.
Yeah. So this is where your practice of loving yourself.
Spend time in that very, what you were talking
yes.
about. I've spent time in it, and I identify with that, the practice.
Yeah.
And not practicing form.
Yeah.
Because you want to practice at being adept at this skill.
Yeah.
Constantly. Constancy.
Yeah.
With your energy, shedding the five
yeah.
layers of Maya. The story. All that. But being constant.
Yeah.
For the rest of my life.
Yeah.
In becoming adept.
Yeah.
And for that same reason, I question
yeah.
why I have to speak while a teacher is teaching.
Yeah. Well, partly because I'm inviting you to speak while I'm teaching. But I understand when you feel the pressure as the need to speak. So what is the speaking providing? It's providing that sense of we're part of it. We're in the same and yes together.
But wait.
And practicing loving yourself, you'll start to feel that all the time, that you're part of this, part of it together. And so then it'll be more possible to feel in this given situation, rather than me as teacher in a concrete shape that then there's the predictable reaction to, you as student closed off over there, and that only through speaking out loud is there the connection acknowledged, or the communication happening, or the sense of, ah, yes, we're in it together.
Right.
But being in it together already makes it different when that arises of, oh, constancy. Constancy is a great word. And it also gives much more the feeling of the love, like the constancy of the love of staying true. So when that sense of urgency of speaking comes, then there'll be the possibility of just letting it come. And not the immediate, like, I shouldn't. It might not be in words, shouldn't, but some kind of like, oh, nope. And then the justifying or controlling, and often both. We often will at the same time justify and try to control and hide the reaction. But rather to let the reaction come into the space of this, of here, or whatever. Let's not put a name on it. Allows something else to happen instead of the chain of reaction. So feeling the pressure of anywhere along the way, when you just feel it and let it be, it can take another track instead of the tried and true.
Thank you for showing me what, because you answered my question. You said you're feeling separate when you're not.
Yeah.
And that's what urged the need to talk.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I wouldn't have had that need.
Well, then if the need arises when there's not so much sense of separation, then it might be that it's needed that you say that word, because we need to hear that word in this moment. And in this case, because it happened in this way, now you're learning, and we're learning with you. We got the word, which I'm happy to have, and we got a great example of what we've been talking about the whole time to end the talk. And you have a better way of knowing what we talked about earlier of loving yourself. So you can also call it practicing non-separation. Playing with remembering what is this sense of separation that's here? Is it true? What does it feel like? It's heavy, it's pressure, etc. It squeezes out these words, and so on. And so what's lovely is, even if you would maybe later think that was a mistake because it came from a sense of separation, it came. And so we got the word, and you got this learning, and we got this learning, and so on. And next time you might not feel the need to say it, something. Yeah, good. So it's 15 minutes till dinner time. Yeah, so what time shall we say?